Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the attack on Iran by the U.S. and Israel will have devastating consequences for Iran and the region. Is it intending to foment ethnic conflicts as a means to weaken Iran? What are the greater implications of the war for Iran itself, the region, and the globe? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. The United States and Israel have attacked Iran. This is a war of choice, and it will have ramifications for Iran, for the region, and for the globe. The U.S. has really struggled with outlining the justification for the attack, particularly in light of what looked like there was going to be successful negotiations over Iran's nuclear material stockpiles, its ballistic missile program. So is this attack about regime change? Or what exactly is this attack about? On today's show, we're actually going to explore several topics about the war. What is American-Israeli justifications for this attack? How different are those justifications? And are they legal under international legal or normative principles? How the attacks are destabilizing Iran, and what have been the reactions internally, including ethnic conflicts within Iran. Are ground troops going to be utilized? And the U.S. is talking about using Kurdish troops in a similar manner than it did in the war in Iraq. What does this mean for Iranian Kurdistan and for the Kurdish people themselves? Our panel today is Erivand Abrahamian. He is professor emeritus at City University of New York. He's the author of A History of Modern Iran and Inventing the Axis of Evil, The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria. Stephen Zunis, he's professor of politics and program director, Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. He's the author of Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism, and Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution, co-authored with Jacob Mundy. Dr. Haujeen Aziz, she's taught at the American University of Iraq, Soleimani. She's the former co-director of the Kurdish Center for Studies and still does quite a bit of work with them. She's worked closely with refugees and IDPs in Rojava while a member of the Kobane Reconstruction Board after its liberation from ISIS. She has written numerous articles. You can find these at the Kurdish Center for Studies, including Erdogan's Air Force Lays Waste to Rojava Amidst Global Silence and Why PJ on Societal Transformation and Revolutionary Progress. Thank you all so very much for joining us. Erivand, the first question, what's been the developments within Iran since the war has begun? Obviously, the supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khamenei, was killed, and speculation about who's actually, running the country. How weakened is the regime, and just how devastating has this been for the population?
Well, after the protests before the war, there was a lot of mass movements in the streets against the regime. And also the regime brought out its own cohorts into the street. So you could see a very polarized society. Since then, I think things become more complicated because once you have the bombing by the Israelis in the United States, there have been, very bloody incidents, like school kids, girls, 13-year-old girls blown up, 150 of them. So that has, I think, complicated an issue. It doesn't mean the regime has become stronger. It's just people who are criticizing the regime are less likely to come out against the regime when they're seeing the reality. So it's, I think, more the war has brought reality to a lot of the protesters. It doesn't mean they're going to basically rally around the regime, but there is a great deal of discontent. But it, in a way, I think the bombing has weakened opposition inside the country. But then there's, so many grievances in the society that I think what is the agenda is, in fact, as you mentioned, the Kurdish issue, but there are other issues, other ethnic issues, that the Israelis and United States are probably trying to play a card on with, in a way that not to bring regime change. I think that's a euphemism for what they want, because the term is sort of clean cut. You remove one regime, bring another. It's like the old coup d'etat notion. But I don't think that's in the books, and I know that they know it's not in the books. What they're planning is to flood the country with arms, as they did with other countries, especially Syria. Have a civil war. Basically, there'll be no Iran for foreseeable future. Maybe after millions of people have died and had to flee the country, some group will then become ascendant and recreate the country. But for the next 10, 15 years, I would suspect the Israeli policy and the US follows that policy, is there'll be no Iran to think about, so you don't have to worry about Iran.
And the protest movement that's been certainly hindered, if not defanged, and the possibility of regime collapse or certainly some sort of change within the regime. What's the possibility of chaos? And immediately what comes to mind is Libya, where the toppling of the government ended up leading to incredible chaos and civil war. Is it how real is that possibility within Iran?
Well, it wasn't just Libya. It was, the same happened in Iraq. It happened in Syria. Israelis see that that was a success and they could try it in Iran. Unfortunately, it's possible. A lot of Iranians say we're different, we're more civilized, we're more smart. But when you have a society with so many issues of discontent and also ethnic issues that may not be now open, but can be basically prodded into being an issue, that could lead to a lot of basically ethnic conflicts. The Israelis for the last 10 years have had an unhealthy interest in ethnic divisions in Iran. So it's clearly in their sights to create an ethnic chaos. It's not only the Kurds. There are the Baluchis, there's the Arabs, Turkmens. And for the last 10 years, they've been very much interested in the Azerbaijan issue. I think they've thought out their agenda, and it's no cost to basically to United States, but it's a heavy cost to Iran, the neighbors, even Europe. The mass exodus to Europe wasn't just from Libya. It started with Iraq, then it's extended to Syria, and then to Libya. The same thing could happen very much here. And Iran has had much larger population, of course. It's over 90 million people.
Stephen Zunis, we've been talking a bit about Israeli motivations. I do want to drill down into some of those, but I do want to make sure that we talk about American motivations. I've been struggling with this question. Maybe you can, give me some insight. What exactly is the U.S.'s motivation in launching these attacks? And what's the U.S. trying to accomplish?
It's unclear. The official motivations are easily debunked. Iran was not within a couple of weeks of developing a nuclear weapon, nothing like that. They are not responsible for thousands of American deaths with IEDs and the like. Those were planted mostly by the Salafist and Ba'athist Iraqis, who are anti-Iranian. I could go down the list. It was they Iran has only used their missiles when attacked first. Not only is Israel far more powerful than Iran, but Saudi Arabia and UAE have a larger military budget. This idea that there's some kind of imminent threat is nuts, and that's why it's important to not call this a preemptive war. Preemptive war implies that a country was on the verge of invading, or you caught them, loading missiles in the missile launchers, that kind of thing. This is what you might call preventive war, an offensive war, clear violation of the United Nations Charter. Not that Trump cares about that sort of thing. In terms of the actual motivations, I think it's similar to Israel. I think they want to basically destroy Iran, turn it into a failed state. I don't think they realistically think they can install the Shah's son or anything like that. It's not the kind of regime where you overthrow one bad guy and suddenly there's a political opening. And indeed, Iranian Revolutionary Guard, in certain ways, has as much power, if not more, than the clerics. And in certain ways, Iran is as much a military dictatorship as it is a theocracy. And the Revolutionary Guard had their fingers into everything, from industry to tourist hotels to technical colleges. They're entrenched pretty hard. And as much as I supported the pro-democracy movement from below, that's the way I think there really should be change. I knew that was going to be a tough row, and this is through bombing is even worse, because I don't know of no regime has been brought down through air power alone. This is an existential struggle for them. They're just going to keep on firing missiles as they get more and more desperate. So, in other words, I think the goal is to basically send a message to the world that if you defy us, we're going to destroy you. You do what the United States wants, and or these will be the consequences. And so, we'll not only have the ethnic uprisings. Let's recall that barely half of the population is actually ethnic Persians. But you have these, various armed ethnic groups, but you also have leftists and Islamists and monarchists and others, fighting among themselves amid the rubble. The thing is, let's remember that Iran is not only a large country of 90 million people, but it's been a major regional power on and off for 2,500 years. And they're not a banana republic that the U.S. can push around. So I think the nationalist sentiments, even by the strongest regime opponents, are coming to the fore as well. But will it be enough to hold it together in the face of all this onslaught? That remains to be seen.
And Haujin Aziz, we've been talking about the Israeli motivation, the American motivation at promoting ethnic divisions, ethnic fighting within Iran. You certainly have a pretty, unique perspective with that in the Kurdish region. What are the implications for the Kurdish population? Actually, before we do that, let me ask you, could you describe the Kurdish population within Iran? Give us a little bit of a background into who the Kurdish people are within Iran, and then we can talk about what the implications are.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
So the Kurds are one of the largest minorities in Iran. The Kurds have, since the very beginning, wanted and demanded ethnic and religious rights, like many other minorities across Iran. Unfortunately, their demands for autonomy and representation has been met previous to the 1979 revolution by significant repression by the Pahlavi regime, and then post-1979 regime significantly and even more increasingly institutionalized violence and repression. Executions are widespread. And so the Kurds are one of the most oppressed minorities. And perhaps this is why, often when there are uprisings across Iran, it often emerges across the Kurdish regions. The Kurdish people are very much invested, very much integral, and central to the current discussion that is unfolding in relation to Iran. The future of Iran needs to be determined by a multitude of different communities and voices. And as we've seen within the international community, the people's voices across Iran is being appropriated by outside forces. People are purporting to speak for us and purport to know what we want, specifically as Kurds, but collectively and more widely across Iran as well. So the Kurds have always demanded, freedom, demanded autonomy, cultural rights, the right to speak our language, the ability to live with our cultural colors and language and identity. And this has represented in a multitude of different uprisings and protests against Iran. And when I say Iran, I mean in the 20th century, it goes both the regime of Shah, but also again, post-1979. During the Shah regime, there were a multitude of revolts, tribal revolts. Then we had the essential 1946 Republic of Mahabad, which is really a defining moment in the collective memory and trauma of Kurds and their Kurdish experience and identity representation across Iran. And so the 1946 Republic of Mahabad represented the culmination of Kurdish aspiration in forming a statehood. Of course, the republic only lasted about a year, and then it was heavily crushed, which leads to the other essential experience that the Kurds have on the ground in Iran, that of repeated cycles of betrayal. With Mahabad, it was the Soviet Union, and then after that, it was consecutive experiences of betrayal. And I'm not talking just about the Kurds in Iran at this stage, but Kurds collectively across the four parts of Kurdistan. So the discussion right now for us as Kurds watching what is unfolding is around this idea of betrayal again. It seems very much imminent and on the horizon. But this discussion also relates to our experience of Kurds in Rojava. And what we saw unfold in the Kurdish regions in northeast Syria, the Kurds, as a result of the rise of ISIS, formed an autonomous region. They established a grassroots democracy, and part of that process involved developing self-defense units, which eventually led to the Syrian Democratic Forces. We've seen very vividly and very painfully for us Kurds, the utter and complete betrayal of the Kurds in Rojava. And so, coming into this discussion about the situation and role of the Kurds, we are entering this discussion from the lens of the last 2 months of extensive violence, massacres, ethnic cleansing, sexual violence against our women and children and girls. And so, we are incredibly wary, incredibly concerned, and very, very hesitant about getting involved with anyone at this stage as Kurds.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Today's topic, we're talking about the war in Iran, the implications for security within Iran, from the region, and the implications from the globe. Our guests today are Ervand Abrahamian. He is from City University of New York. Stephen Zunis, he's from the University of San Francisco. And Haujeen Aziz from the Kurdish Center for Studies. So, Ervan, what Hajin's describing here, first of all, you had talked about how the aggressors, how Israel, the United States, are seeking ethnic tensions, ethnic conflicts, and even possibly trying to create a failed state or at least a chaotic state. First of all, how would that be accomplished? Do you have an expectation it's going to be the attempts to try to arm some of the different groups to try to attack one another? And ultimately, how much do you see the groups rising up to that, especially as Hajin just pointed out, at least with the Kurds, there's been so many promises and so little follow-through, even betrayal of these different groups.
Well, I think the example of Syria is here. In the Syrian case, when there was popular uprising in the streets against Assad, Obama opposed intervention. But what was done was the pouring of American arms into Syria. It doesn't matter who it went to. It just the arms poured in, probably from Turkey, but it was American arms, so it must have been done with at least the blind eye in Washington. And it didn't matter who it went to. Some of the arms actually went to ISIS. So ISIS had a good supply of American weapons to both challenge Assad and also to challenge Baghdad. So, and eventually America had to come in with Iranian help, in fact, to destroy ISIS. So they don't really worried about the costs. All you have to do is pour in arms. Arms will go into everywhere. It's not just the Kurdish border. Of course, there's a Iraqi border, there is the Baluchi border, there is the northern border with Azerbaijan. Arms could be just poured into the country. And this is, I suspect, will happen in the next few weeks. And it doesn't matter who it goes to. In the Kurdish areas, there are two parties, the Kurdish Democratic Party and the Komule. And they may be savvy enough to know the complications and the betrayals, but they may not be basically the main instrument. Across the border in Iraq, there are two Kurdish mini states, both of them very reliant on Israel. So arms could pour in through there, going to anyone, basically. And then you get a free-for-all. So it may cost heavily for the Kurds, but the Kurds will be used as they were before. And I'm not sure whether the two Kurdish mini-states in Iraq are that worried about being used. I mean, they saw what happened across in the Syrian border, where the Kurds did have their own democratic republic for a while, and then they got betrayed by Israel and United States.
And Stephen, then one of the models seems to be, and you talked about the idea of these conflicts and failed state, the inability of Iran to be able to project any sort of power. It's just kind of like states within states, or at least battles over these states within states. Is that a potential motivation? Because in Iraq, the obsession always seemed to be that if these different groups ended up fighting within Iraq, that the civil war would be disastrous. Would that be welcomed by the Israelis and by the Americans? Just a civil war in states within states fighting one another?
I mean, I think in Iraq, the United States did want to see a certain degree of divisions. They wanted to suppress the Arab nationalism that the Ba'athists had advocated for a long time, but I didn't think they expected or wanted things to get as out of control as they did. I think in Iran, frankly, I'm cynical enough about Trump and Netanyahu and their crowd that they wouldn't mind if all hell broke loose, in the sense that as long as they were fighting each other. And because, again, the idea, I believe, is to weaken Iran. Because, I mean, there's plenty of things we all can say about how horrible and reactionary and oppressive the Iranian regime is. But that's really not what this is about. The fact is that Iran was the final obstacle to American and Israeli hegemony in the region. I mean, since Assad's overthrow, they didn't no longer had a state ally, and Hezbollah and Houthis have certainly been weakened by the constant bombardment. So this seemed to be the time to move. So really, this is about hegemony. This is about the full spectrum dominance that the Bush administration first put forward. And it's kind of interesting. Back in the 1990s, I wrote an article. This is the triumph of neoliberalism, and the international financial institutions like the World Trade Organization and the IMF could keep countries in line from going too socialist or going too much their own way. And I said, I don't think the United States is going to have coups or interventions anymore because we have these mechanisms in place to keep countries from straying, too far from this kind of hegemonic system. And I said there are only three exceptions in the global South of countries that have a sizable educated population, adequate food and water resources, and substantial oil wealth. That these three are powerful enough to stand up to this kind of a hegemonic neoliberal order, and those were Iraq, Venezuela, and Iran. And so it's no accident that the U.S. has actually gone to war with all three of these. And I really think that again, this is what it's about. Where the mistake, I think, the United States is making, frankly, parallel an earlier mistake, a big mistake in Vietnam, was we saw it as this totalitarian reach to take over the world, and the way you handle that is through brute military force. What we didn't realize was that the National Liberation Front, what we call the Viet Cong, while communist-led, was first and foremost a nationalist movement. And so the more we bombed, the more troops we sent, the greater the resistance. I think the big mistake we're making with Iran, notwithstanding the non-Persian groups there, is that there's a strong sense of nationalism. Indeed, for my most recent visit to Iran, you saw a lot more nationalistic slogans and flags and things than you saw Islamic slogans. The fact we're focusing on the Islamist part of it, what we don't realize, we have a people who are very proud of their 2,500-year-old culture and don't like being pushed around. So I think we will see a degree of resistance to the war, even by some of the regime's strongest Persian critics. And how that will relate to the separatist ambitions of other ethnic groups that might want to take part of the situation, or how much they might want to join in the overall resistance as Iranians, albeit non-Persian ones, remains to be seen. But I think if the United States thinks it can kind of divide things up in a way that will be beneficial for the United States and bring any kind of stability or that kind of thing, that's a big mistake. There's going to be all sorts of chaos, all sorts of resistance.
And Hajin, I'd love to get your thoughts on this as well. This idea of the purpose is to try to divide as a way to simply weaken Iran, and the governance within Iran or stability or peace within Iran is simply, it may not even not be a priority. The purpose might actually be to create chaos as a way to try to weaken Iran.
Absolutely. I think the objective is to foment as much discontent and conflict internally to weaken the regime. I think a really good comparison is the 2003 invasion of Iraq by the United States and the absolute debacle that ensued after that. We saw, as a result, ethnic and religious tensions. We saw sectarian violence between Shiite and Sunni factions. And consequently, we ended up with the wonderful organization that was ISIS, that went on a massive rampage of murder and rape and pillage across the region. which continues to foment instability across all of Middle East at the moment. So I think the American regime, Trump, doesn't actually have a long-term plan. I think this is a very emotional minute-by-minute response to events unfolding, and the objective is try to remove the regime, which rightfully so has been very, very repressive and very violent and very authoritarian, and this is all documented and noted, especially towards minorities. But I think there is no grand plan at the moment, because what we're seeing as Kurds and the efforts by the Americans and the Israelis to connect with us and to try to initially encourage us with a carrot, and now increasingly it appears in the last statement made by Trump that the Kurds, if they refuse to participate, the Kurds from South Kurdistan in northern Iraq, if they refuse to participate and be the boots on the ground, then we're either with the United States and America or with the Iranian regime, which is absolutely not true. And it is possible for people to have an alternative third position in which we refuse to be pulled into and forced into and pressured into wars that we have not started, wars that we are not interested in contributing to. I think what people want as a result of the repeated cycles of uprising across Iran is democratization. They want human rights, they want women rights, they want minority rights, they want ethnic and religious rights to be guaranteed. And there's a lot of discussion about separatism, there's a lot of discussions around the Kurds being this destabilizing force, and it is endangering our lives. It is actually increasing the Iranian regime's violence and bombardments and missiles and drone attacks against the Kurds, both within Rosh Halat in the Kurdish parts of Iran, also in Bashur in the Kurdish parts of Iraq. And so we are very wary of this. We would like to know what the larger goal is, because we are at the center of this conflict. What we've seen in Syria, what we've seen in Iraq, and what we've seen in Iran, in the Kurdish regions, the wars always come to the Kurdish regions. The Kurds are always politically pressured, forced, or strong-armed into participating in wars. As an example, for example, in Rojava, the Kurds' resistance and rights for autonomy and legitimate grievances against the brutality of the Assad regime was very much appropriated. The international left very much saw the Kurds as proxies of the United States, for example, because they were fighting, they were coalition, partners in the war against ISIS. But the Kurds had to resist because ISIS was at their doorsteps. It was killing and raping and pillaging and murdering everybody. So they had to resist. So they made an international call for arms, especially in 2014 when Kobani was being attacked. And so, as a result of international pressure within the community and solidarity movements and so on, and human rights organizations, the United States and the coalition allies responded by providing arms. And as Professor Arvand mentioned, a lot of these arms actually ended up being thrown on the side of the ISIS, controlled territories. And then ISIS promptly used it to continue to massacre and terrorize people. So, what we're seeing, particularly from the Kurdish perspective, is a lot of inconsistencies within American, foreign policy towards the Middle East. It seems that foreign policy advisors aren't very aware of the history of the diverse peoples and communities and their objectives and desires and their histories of resistance against the regime. And so, as Kurds, when we say that we don't want to be armed and we don't want to be foot soldiers, it's because of that long history of inconsistency, because nothing is guaranteed. And in fact, as Kurds in Rosh Halat, one of our major fears is that we would be forced somehow into this war. We will bleed and die on the front lines. And then, as soon as the revolution or the resistance or the regime change occurs, we have Reza Pahlavi being imposed on us as the new dictator, promoting a very specific form of Persian nationalism that denies the rights of other minorities across the region. So there's a lot of inconsistency, there's a lot of confusion about the American approach towards the region. And unfortunately, as Kurds, we're being put to the front lines and being forced to sacrifice our lives and bodies again.
When we come back, what are the possibilities of a successful resistance to American and Israeli aggression for an unpopular war, both domestically and around the world?
Come, you masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. either hide behind walls, either hide behind desks. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. If one of the aims of the war on Iran is to foment ethnic tensions within the country and region, could it actually backfire? Could it instead build national support for the embattled Iranian regime? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Our panel today is Erivand Abrahamian. He's professor emeritus at City University of New York. Stephen Zunis, he's professor of politics and the program director for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. And Haujin Aziz, she's taught at the American University of Iraq in Soleimani and the co-director, Kurdish Center for Studies. Work quite a bit within the region, providing a particular Kurdish perspective, as well as many other things. Erivand, you had a response to some of Haujin's comments prior to the break, and then also sort of broadly this question, is there a possibility that resistance could take the form of rejecting the different ethnic divisions within Iran?
The thing is actually, it's more complicated. The Israeli strategy is not just the Kurdish issue. It's basically to cause as much chaos as possible. So you pour in arms and anyone then can pick it up and cause problems. The Kurdish issue is interesting. In the last protests, street protests, the Kurdish area was actually relatively quiet. It was more in the heartland, you had more demonstrations. So it's not as if they're the front line of opposition. Also, Trump the other day said he didn't want to appoint who would be the leader after the change of so-called change of regime. Again, he's playing it sort of trying to be clever that, you know, I'll put my money on whoever thinks is the best. And that may be because if they pour money to so-called monarchists or the Mujahideen, I suspect there are some people still in Washington think that the Mujahideen is another horse they can put their money on. It doesn't matter to them. If the aim is just basically state destruction, chaos, you give gun to anyone, even if it was ISIS. And also, actually, ISIS has some support in the Baluchi areas in the south. So that's a much more of a Sunni area. So it would be no skin off their backs if there's a revival of ISIS. And there's been plenty of ISIS, actually, terrorism in Iran in the last 10 years. So they got their equipment and basically supplies from somewhere abroad. But going back to your question about what is American national interests, because that's often the question, is it the same as Israeli interests? The question then presupposes there is some sort of organization that creates national interest. For a long time, basically, as far as Iran is concerned, there's been no State Department, there's been no National Security Council. I don't know anyone in Washington who knows anything about Iran. So what's happened, this is a policy of different administrations from the hostage crisis. U.S. has outsourced its Iran policy to Israel. The view has been that, well, the Israelis know what happens in Iran. They have information. If we want advice, we want information, we go to the Israelis, save money. We don't have to have a bureaucracy and stuff. And there's really no one in Washington who knows the slightest thing about Iran. So it's easy to basically defer to the Israelis. So the Israelis have their own national interests, which not be in the same national interests of the United States, but no U.S. national interests have been articulated. So it's easy for a president like Trump to basically listen to Bibi, what would be good. I mean, the only exception from the hostage crisis to the present time was the short period for Obama, when Obama actually decided that there was American national interest. It wasn't the same as the Israeli interest. And that basically created outrage in Tel Aviv Remember, Bibi came all the way to Washington to undermine Obama's policy because it could lead to a sort of a peace agreement, and that created peace panic in Tel Aviv. They didn't want that. But otherwise, even with Biden, after all, was Obama's vice president. You would expect Biden to follow Obama's policy. No, he considered himself a full Zionist and basically followed Israeli policy.
And by the way, when you talk about Obama's policy, you're talking about the JCPOA, the non-nuclear deal, right? Stephen, I'd love to sort of raise that same question here as well. The alignment between Israeli foreign policy and American foreign policy. Erevan's kind of described it as the U.S. has pretty much just deferred to Israel. Would you agree?
Not quite. I mean, there have been elements within the more militaristic foreign policy elites that came to the fore during the Bush administration, the neoconservatives and the old style militarists like Cheney and Rumsfeld. I mean, they were chomping at the bit to go after Iran as well. In fact, they were seriously considering something very similar to what we're seeing now in the immediate aftermath of the Iraq war before things, Iraq invasion, before things started going really bad. And the reason they didn't do it was they got a lot of pushback from the Pentagon, from the intelligence community, from a handful of people in the State Department who really did know Iran. And basically, these people don't give a damn about international law or human rights or civilians getting killed in general, but they figure that the cost benefit analysis, said that this would be a mess, that this would not be worth it. And we're already seeing the consequences that these people warned about, and they're going to only get worse. I think Trump, though, doesn't like experts. He doesn't like advice. He thinks he knows better than everybody. And so my sense is that, though obviously he's been coordinating very closely with Israel, he's been listening to some of what the Israelis said. I frankly think he would have gone to war regardless. I really do. That he's being a bully. He really does think he can rebuild the world on his image. And so I don't see this as being on behest of Israel. Though again, you can't deny that Bibi has been looking, been wanting to see this kind of thing for some time. He's been pushing it for quite a long time, and he's finally there's a president in Washington who is willing to take those incredible risks. But I do think it's more of a matter of their agendas corresponding, not a sense that Netanyahu forced him into it or anything like that.
Dr. Haujian, we've been talking a lot about Iran's relationship with Israel and certainly with the United States, but there's another actor that is almost never discussed or hasn't been discussed this past week all that much. And in particular, I think within the Kurdish region, it's hard to imagine these questions without turning to Turkey and thinking about, the impact regionally. I know recently there have been attacks in Azeri regions and attacks against Azerbaijan. What role do you see Turkey playing, especially because I know that in Iraq, for example, and in Syria, Syria in particular, Turkey took advantage of some openings and attacked Kurdish areas that attacked the Kurdish people. I would expect the same thing would happen if there was some attempt to try to arm the Kurds to try to be the boots on the ground in Iran.
Yes, absolutely. I think Turkey is very much geopolitically, regionally, very much integral to the unfolding situation in Iran. Publicly and openly, Turkey has criticized the United States and Israel's attacks on Iran. But we know that behind the scenes, Turkey is very much closely monitoring the unfolding situation because it's not one of its major concerns and issues is Kurdish rights and Kurdish autonomy. We saw across the Rojava region that Turkey was integral in the destabilization and the reduction of, the powers and the authorities of the autonomous administration in northeast Syria. Turkey has also been integral, and I think we should probably touch on this topic as well in relation to the United States policies in the region, in Syria and the Kurdish question, in bringing about the al-Jolani or Ahmad al-Sharr regime into power. It has been integral in bringing a new regime into power in Syria, which is very much hardline Islamist. Al-Jolani and the current Syrian transitional government consist of former ISIS, al-Qaeda, and HTS remnants, And they have openly advocated for a very specific national agenda and state building project for Syria post the Assad regime, the removal of the Assad regime. So Turkey was integral through this process. It was actively, bombarding the Kurds in northeast Syria while the Syrian transitional forces were attacking the Kurds and attempting to push back the territories that they had gained as a result of the revolution in Rojava. So on the back of that context, when we look at what's happening in Iran and this ongoing discussion about fomenting internal conflict in Iran, Turkey is monitoring the events on the ground. It's very much especially in relation to Pejak, which is widely perceived to be allied with the PKK, and is Turkey's very much against. Ankara considers Pejak to be linked to obviously the PKK, and so it's concerned about any statements that is emerging. Pejak itself has actually just come out in the last, I think, 48 hours calling for people to within the Kurdish communities to engage in self-defense maneuvers if they're going to be attacked, following calls by the international media and international community that the Kurds are actually on the ground right now engaging in some sort of a mass-scale warfare against the Iranian regime. And so Turkey is very much integral in making sure that Kurdish rights are limited. Otherwise, it's very much aligned with ensuring that the Iranian regime maintains its position in power, because we've seen through public rhetoric, open statements by the Israeli members of the state that Turkey is essentially next. Now, on some level, as Kurds, we're kind of cheering the way that we cheered that when Khamenei was assassinated, because we have experienced significant, ongoing, decades-long repression at the hands of Erdogan, who is essentially a self-appointed new Ottoman sultanate, self-appointed, I should say. Really, the position, I think, for all minorities, and if I may be so bold as to speak for minorities across the region in Syria, in Turkey, and in Iraq and in Iran, is that we want our ethnic and religious and cultural rights to be guaranteed and to be protected. We demand human rights. This is non-negotiable. It is no longer a discussion in which we are willing to engage in with these repressive states, because their response has always been annihilation, ethnic cleansing, genocide, executions. And so it is a very complex and unfolding situation. Turkey is very much integral. Wherever there's a single Kurd involved in anything, Turkey will be involved.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about the war in Iran and the implications that has for populations in Iran and across the region. Our guests today are Ervan Abrahamian. He is from City University of New York. Stephen Zunis, he's from the University of San Francisco. And Haujin Aziz from the Kurdish Center for Studies. Stephen, I want to bring you in. I mean, there's a real fear, obviously, that this war could spread throughout the region. The neighboring countries, we've talked about Turkey a bit here and a little bit about Iraq. In your estimation, what have been some of the real concerns that the neighboring countries, the regional countries, have had about the war and the possibility they could find themselves being sucked into the war?
But they already have. I mean, Iran has attacked, what is it, six or eight countries now, and not just American military bases, American installations, which legally they would have the right to do since they were attacked first, but military and civilian and governmental infrastructures in these Arab Gulf states, including those that warned against this, the U.S. attack, for this very reason, that they knew that they would be targeted. Now, I think the Iranians are thinking perhaps, well, if we show them that this kind of a destruction is going to happen, they will pressure the United States to stop the war. But instead, I think it's had the opposite effect, that they have gotten these nations to cooperate with the United States in their defense, if not actually offensive attacks against Iran. But let's remember that this is an existential struggle for the regime. They're already very isolated. They've been isolated in the region for many years, and they're just going to lash out regardless. The fact that they're slamming all these rockets and missiles into Dubai again, and UAE has not been a supporter of the U.S. Effort, but Dubai in many ways just sort of represents the opulence and waste and abandonment of any kind of pan-Arab or pan-Islamic sense of social responsibility, and to say, basically send the message: nowhere is safe. If you're going after us, there's going to be nowhere within the 1,800 miles range of our missiles that is going to be unscathed. And And again, that's this. I was actually kind of hoping. One reason I was a little surprised that the Trump launched a war on this scale is that I thought he might listen to some of his buddies in the Arab Gulf, whom I think he's at least as close with as he is with Netanyahu, and they would advise such caution. But you know, he's very arrogant and thinks he knows better than even the people in the region. And the people in the region are feeling the consequences. I keep thinking about the old African proverb, when elephants fight, the grass gets trampled. And you know, so we're seeing Iranian civilians, the majority of whom presumably do not like the regime, who are being killed. You know, we're seeing Israeli civilians and Arab civilians and others on a much smaller scale, but nevertheless, they're dying as well. And you know, this is the consequences when you have you know, both both a government, you know, like Iran, that's extreme enough to basically say, you know, we're willing on principle to stand and fight no matter the consequences, no matter how many of our own people are gonna get killed. I mean, after all, they killed thousands of their own people just a few weeks ago. And of course, the imperial hegemonic agenda of Trump and the United States, and that's such a deadly combination.
And Evan, I want to raise this issue as well. This question, why are they launching at UAE or Qatar or whatever? But of course, Iran's foreign policy over the course of the last 20 years or so, there's been such an intense rivalry, with the Gulf states, with Saudi Arabia and states that are aligned with Saudi Arabia. And the perception is the U.S. has certainly picked a horse in that race and the desire to
Though
continue.
in more recent time, there's actually been a degree of rapprochement. You know, they've actually tried to heal some of those more serious rifts. And so again, the timing of this of the war is one that I think there are a number of Gulf officials who are saying, "Hey, we finally got some semblance of détente here. What in the hell are you doing, Trump?"
And also, everyone, I mean, one of the big issues, and I know that what was driving some of the protests was this perception that the regime, particularly under Ayatollah Khamenei, was spending just so much money and so many resources trying to support different groups. And so the expectation was always there was going to be some degree of retrenchment on the part of the Iranians, even if it wasn't ideological, just good old-fashioned material. They were spending so much money. And my understanding, at least at the core of the protests, was really protests about the economic collapse. And so I guess the question here is, did the war undermine all of that?
For the diaspora opposition and also opposition in Iran, it was easy to criticize the regime for saying so-called spending so much money. Actually, the Iranian military expenditures drastically decreased after the Shah fell, and Iran didn't put money into a sort of regular military, hard with heavy costs and so on. The money that was going, I think, to so-called proxies is exaggerated, in fact. I mean, how much does it cost to pay a daily wage to a foot soldier? You get someone from Herat, a Shia from Afghanistan, who's willing to go to Damascus and fight for Assad. How much is it going to cost the Iranian government for that? So this was basically a polemical issue that people who oppose the regime could use, so saying you're wasting our money. So I think that was exaggerated. But, after the revolution was clear cut, Khomeini was against all the monarchies. In fact, he argued all monarchies are all pagan, they should all disappear. This obviously was a challenge to all the Gulf states, the Saudis. But that all changed about 10 years ago. Iran has actually spent a lot of time building good relations with the Arab states. What they're doing now is again pretty rational from their point of view. They're trying to make the costs of business in the whole region, especially oil, gas exports, so costly that it'll affect United States eventually, and of course the Gulf states too. I mean, the Gulf states depend on foreign investments, but foreign visitors, foreign basically. circulation, and the more chaos they can create with missile bombing, that's going to directly affect all the Gulf states. And they're trying to cause pain for them to give as little support to the United States and Israel.
We have just a few minutes left, and I'm going to start this with Dr. Aziz. This is a war that I think it's fair to say is quite unpopular. Unpopular, certainly in the United States, the opinion polls are suggesting this. But globally, the best you can say is there may be some skeptical support, but it seems to be pretty unpopular across the region. What's the possibility that this is going to fail precisely because Iran, who had been isolated, it could actually, potentially draw in supporters, not necessarily support the regime, but they definitely oppose the way that the US and Israel are using military strikes.
Absolutely. I think the war is not popular. I don't think anybody wants war. I think in the scale of some of the ongoing genocides that are unfolding globally, with the mass and sheer scale of violence and human carnage, nobody wants this war. I know within the Kurdish movement, as diverse as it is, we are very much anti-war because as Kurds, the wars always come to the areas that we reside within. So we become doubly, sacrificed at the altar of the objectives of empire and their industrial war complex objectives, which cyclically and often and repeatedly brings wars to our doorsteps. We hope that the war will not continue. We hope that dialogue and democracy and human rights and discussions on a diplomatic level will continue. How realistic that is, knowing the reality and the brutality of the Iranian regime and the previous failed bombings by Israel and the United States, I'm not really sure. But the ideal outcome would be a regime change internally from the people, whatever their desires and objectives will be. And because we know that the process towards democratization is a lengthy one, it's not an objective that is achieved overnight. Organic democratic processes and institution building, nation state building, which the Iranian regime, whatever shape or form it takes from now on, needs to engage in very actively to foment unity across economic, social, gender, something that we didn't really much discuss and we should have really touched on that,
Absolutely.
and ethnic and religious and gender lines. It's very important that these fractures, that these ethnic and religious cleavages are addressed because there can be no stability long term for the Iranian regime. And we've seen with the Reza Pahlavi, the Pahlavi regime previously, and the Islamic regime, both have failed in effective nation state building measures, legitimacy building, and building unity and fomenting, justice and involvement and inclusion for diverse groups and ethnicities. You continue to feel outside of this discussion, continue to be marginalized, continue to be silenced, and their legitimate grievances to be appropriated and taken over by external forces and voices.
Stephen, your thoughts?
Again, this underscores what I was saying earlier about the powerful nationalist side that the U.S. may underestimate. But I want to address the popularity question and domestically in the United States, and that is the fact that this is unprecedented to have a majority of Americans opposing a war at the outset. I mean, even the very controversial wars like Iraq, once the war was launched, people rally around the flag, support our troops, etc. And the war was actually quite popular until the resistance arose, and it ended up being a long, bloody counterinsurgency, kind of situation. Here, the support for the war, the poll showing support for going to war, is something like 21%. A week or so ago, and I think it's only gone up to 31%, 31%, with a majority opposing. I mean, it's not even close. And this, again, this is unprecedented, and I can only imagine that it's going to get worse. And I've already had a couple of interviews about the domestic political implications in terms of the midterm elections and Trump and his MAGA base, and his getting elected on the grounds of bring the troops home, America first, and all this kind of thing. And that'll be interesting to watch. But it also raises the question about how long can we sustain a major war with this level of unpopularity?
And by the way, the need apparently for new funding for the war, I think is going to raise
Yeah, this is a very
questions.
expensive war.
Yeah, no,
We should
absolutely.
already.
Ervan, I'm going to give you the last word on this question, the possibility of successful resistance, both within Iran, but also globally resistance, because there's been so much opposition to the war.
Well, I don't know if the global opposition has any effect on Washington. They think they can do whatever they want, and they usually get away with it. But in terms of on the unpopularity of the war, I am quite actually struck that it is so unpopular. There's a wonderful statement by one of the architects of the Iraqi war. He said at the beginning, it's not that Americans dislike war. They like war. What they dislike is losing wars. I wouldn't say that for generally, but I think for the Trump's base, MAGA base, that's very much their attitude. War is a good thing. It's heroism, a macho. It provides a social mobility for people and so on. But if it's a war that drags on and your victory is not in sight, then it becomes unpopular. So in this case, if there is no immediate resolution, I don't see it immediate resolution. I think that's where you'll see a difference between the U.S. and at least Trump and Israel. Trump will be then attempted to declare victory. He could at any time declare decree because it's never clear what the goals were. So he could say, "Well, the goal was to get rid of the supreme leader. We killed him. We won. We'll withdraw." That would then, of course, be a betrayal of Israeli goals. But that would, if the costs become too heavy for him, and if the war drags on, there will be costs to him. He could always withdraw from that because his, of course, a priority is to remain president, get his basically legislation through the Congress.
Our panel today is Ervand Abrahamian. He is Professor Emeritus at City University of New York and the author of A History of Modern Iran. Stephen Zunis, he's Professor of Politics and the Program Director for Middle East Studies at the University of San Francisco and the author of Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. Dr. Haujean Aziz, she's taught at the American University of Iraq Soleimani, and she's the co-director of the Kurdish Center for Studies. She's worked closely with refugees, IDPs in Rojava, while a member of the Kobane Reconstruction Board after its liberation from ISIS. And you can find numerous articles she's written at the Kurdish Center for Studies website. I want to thank all three of you for your time, for your expertise, some really striking insights, and for informing me as well as everybody else on this incredibly important issue. Thank you.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on at Scholar Circle or me at Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.
He fastened all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud.